Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 3rd. I'm Brian Shields, and for Ray Graff, a star-studded affair today as we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to take your questions. On astronomy, Bob is one of the best-known and most widely read astronomers anywhere in the world, and in the universe for that matter. He's been featured in Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine, and the Old Farmer's Almanac. The number to call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. I hear an eclipse is coming up in about 3 weeks. We'll talk certainly about that, safe way to look at it and where to look at it. Your calls, comments, tweets, and much more, all coming up on Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. But first, some news. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in program. I'm Brian Shields, in for Ray Graff. Today, we welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. One of the best-known and most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob can translate those complex scientific concepts into terms that are easily understood by the casual stargazer, yet meaningful to the most advanced researchers. His dry, edgy wit engages readers of such diverse publications as Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine, and the Old Farmer's Almanac. The phones are open. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Tweet your questions and comments, WAMC Vox Pop, and you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. The number to call is 800-348-2551. Bob, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here, Brian.
August 21st, it's a Monday, the total eclipse of the sun over a large path of North America. Where are you going to be that day?
Our group of 110 people in our science tour group will be in Casper, Wyoming.
Mm-hmm. And that's a total eclipse there? What's going to happen?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. The whole idea is total.
Yeah.
And I guess I shouldn't push it anymore and stop trying to sell it, but after years, starting in 1970, of leading total eclipses and watching people, mostly rich people, spend a fortune going to China or the Libyan desert or places all around the world to see totality, and now having it in America, a lot of people are saying, oh, no, I'm going to see it. I'll see it right from Rhinebeck, where I live, or Socrates, or, you know, wherever. Yes, it's going to be a partial eclipse here. The word eclipse, even though it's used for both, shouldn't be used for both, because totality is one thing when it comes to a solar eclipse, and then a partial eclipse is another thing entirely, and that's what we're going to get.
And if you're here, if you're not in Wyoming, if you're not in the direct path, let's say you're in Albany, you're in Poughkeepsie, Burlington, Vermont, not much to see? You can't look at it, obviously, but will it get dim here?
Yep. It won't get dim, no, because the sun won't even be three quarters covered. It'll be three quarters covered from Poughkeepsie. From Albany here, it'll be less. It'll be closer to two thirds obscured. And so you won't really notice, looking around, a dimming of the light. It won't quite equal that of the sun when it's behind a cloud. And unfortunately, people equate solar eclipses with degree of darkness. Mm-hmm. If it's dark, they feel they got their money's worth. And if it's not very dark, then what kind of an eclipse is it? But the real glory of totality is seeing those flames, those deep pink flames, prominences, leaping out like geysers from the edge of the sun, something you never see otherwise, and seeing the fine filamentary lines of the sun's magnetic field in its corona, and the stars coming out in the daytime, at least the brighter ones, and the animals acting up, and people weeping, and all these things happen only at totality. And that's not like a lunar eclipse. In a lunar eclipse, mm-hmm. which we get every few years, yeah. totality is just okay. Sort of interesting. Moon turns a coppery red. So a partial lunar eclipse versus a total lunar eclipse, they're both sort of in the same ballpark in terms of spectacle. But not with a solar eclipse. Their totality makes people weep. It changes lives. It makes people mortgage their house to see it again. Whereas a partial eclipse we get them every few years. You need eye protection, and it's okay. It's kind of interesting. It's sort of interesting, mildly interesting. And that's what we'll have.
800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman on the program today. 800-348-2551. So the sun or the moon moves in front of the sun. That's pretty much it, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, yes.
And it goes at a certain pace so that but why if it covers the sun in partially in some places, why doesn't it cover it all over the place?
Because you have to be in that line. Your spot on Earth has to be aligned in all three dimensions, and the path, the moon's shadow moves around the ground at about 2,000 miles an hour, a little less than that. And so if you're in that spot where the full shadow hits, and it's only 70 miles wide, like Carbondale, Illinois, or Charleston, South Carolina, or Nashville, Tennessee, or Casper, Wyoming, Jackson, Wyoming, places like the Stanley, Idaho, then you get it. Then you see all that phenomena. If you're outside that, everyone else in America sees a partial. Now, that's what we're going to get at 1:23 in the afternoon from Albany on August 21st, with the sun pretty high up, about two-thirds of the way up in the sky. And an hour after that, it'll be maximum eclipse. And if you have eye protection, and that's, I guess, what we should talk about, because eyesight is precious, and there's too many cases of people having permanent injury to their eyes. So you want me to spend a minute on
that? Sure. In fact, Ted is calling, and he wants to know more about that. Ted in Pleasant Valley.
Hi. Good afternoon, folks.
Sure.
I was reading an article here by Bob Berman, and he's recommending a shade number 12 or 14 welder's goggles.
Yes, and this eclipse, probably 14 is probably the better one, but both are safe.
Okay, but I couldn't get the goggles, but the guy says he has like a sheet or a lens that has that value. It's a welding store. Is that adequate?
Absolutely. Yeah, I shouldn't have said goggles, because you don't really need the whole thing to slip on your head unless you're going to be repairing your car at the same time. You just need the replacement filter that goes in the goggles. So your welding guy is absolutely right. If he's in stock with them, and I'm surprised, because usually welders use a shade 10. They don't usually use a 14 or a 12. If he's got them in stock, and I know they're only like $2 or so, definitely grab some. You could grab a bunch of them and then sell them as eclipse day approaches, because they're in demand. 14 would probably be perfect. 12, the image will be a little bright, but still safe.
Okay. I think he said he didn't go to 14, but he has got 12. So I'll go down there and pick some up and pass them around the neighborhood or something.
Good.
Thank you very much. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Any other way of doing this if you can't get a hold of that 14 filter?
There's still time to send away online for eclipse glasses. Most of them are made of cardboard, and they have mylar, a type of plastic that blocks the sun's rays. And since we still have a couple of weeks, there's time to get them fast ordered to you. I like welder's goggles shade 14 only because they're optically so perfect. They give a really nice image, and as I said, they're only about $2 for the filter. And for all these years that we have tours to see eclipses, almost always in strange parts of the world, we've been using these since 1970, and very successfully and safely.
You talked about it sort of riles up the animals. What happens?
Oh, well, they know something is weird. The temperature is falling, and the light turns strange even before the total part of the eclipse begins. The colors are more saturated, shadows are starker, light is more polarized. It's the everyday objects, the trees and houses and cars, everything around you looks very, very weird. We saw that here in Albany for that very deep partial eclipse we had back in 1994, Yeah, 1994. But you need a good 98-99% eclipse to see those strange effects. And here in the whole Northeast, we're not going to be able to have a sun that's eclipsed so deeply. So we're not going to see those weird effects unless you travel. You can see I'm still pushing for people to go to Carbondale and or some of those other places where it'll be total. And I can promise anybody who goes through the trouble, and I know it's a lot of trouble to travel there. It must be a 9-hour drive or something, that they'll be glad they did.
We know the moon can affect the tides. We know the sun can affect radio transmissions, satellites, etc. During the eclipse, does any of that effect happen on the tides, or the satellite transmissions, electronics, etc.?
Well, you certainly get it on the tides because you have the sun and the moon in alignment. We have an alignment every new moon, and so you get higher tides, so-called spring tides, at every new moon. So you get that. Also, to see a total eclipse, it means the moon has to be in the nearer half of its orbit. It has an elliptical or egg-shaped orbit. And only when the moon is in the nearer half does it appear big enough to totally cover the sun. So by definition, on a total eclipse, the moon is also nearer. And that nearness also contributes to the tides, especially in places like the Bay of Fundy, where the tides follow the moon's distance rather than the alignment with the sun. Very, very strange effect up there. So yeah, there's that. But the biggest effect, I'm convinced you'd know it was happening even if you were blind, because there's an impact that goes beyond what you're seeing. And the impact is not just darkness. Mm-hmm. It's these strange things leaping out of the edge of the sun, and these weird thin lines of the sun's magnetic field, and actually seeing the moon in its orbit. You see it visibly moving, like in the beginning of the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. You're seeing celestial bodies changing position before your eyes, and it's really an awesome, in the old-fashioned, meaning, not the way we use it now. Somebody told me when I had exact, they asked me if I had exact change, and when I did it, they said, oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And no, but in the old sense, it's really, really awesome. I mean, it makes people weep. So there it is. And if you miss this one, then you have to wait, because they're somewhere in the world, 3 out of 4 years, there'll be one total eclipse, usually in a hard-to-reach place. For example, next year there's none anywhere. The year after it'll be Chile. And go to a good tour company. Of course, I'm going to recommend the one that I lecture for, which is specialinteresttours.com.
And that's in 2 years?
And that's in 2 years, in 2019. Oddly enough, the next year after that, 2020, it's again Chile, that time in Patagonia. The year after that, there's none. The year after that, it's Antarctica. The year after that, it's Iceland, and then heading down towards just a tiny bit of the eclipse in Spain. We get one in 2027 over Egypt. There won't be another one in America, 2024 on April 8th. Mm-hmm. We're going to have one in our neighborhood.
Right here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Buffalo and Rochester and Syracuse and Burlington, Vermont. So that's April 8th, 2024. So if you miss this one, you'll either have to travel around the world, wait till 2024, and then after that, there's none until August 12th of 2045. And then after that, you have to wait till 2079, and that's the next one we'll have here, right here in Albany, 2079.
That sounds like I won't be here, but I'll have to take the 2024.
So it's not the kind of thing you get every few years. You really have to wait for them, and they're worth it. I mean, to my mind, if you think of your bucket list, what are the things you want to see in this life? Some people say, well, the pyramids of Egypt or the Great Wall of China. I promise that a total solar eclipse will exceed anything you've ever seen or will ever see. It's just the greatest sight of all. But if you stay home and you see the partial, I can't force you. I want to force everyone, but I can't.
800-348-2551. More talk with Bob in a moment.
Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, working on land protection projects that safeguard the water quality of Lake George. Hiking maps, public events, and more at lglc.org. Chester Theater Company, Chester, Massachusetts, presenting Every Brilliant Thing through August 13th. An engaging story of a son's gift to his mother. ChesterTheater.org. Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany, Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume, and cover letter writing. CareersInTransitionLLC.com. The Columbia Paper, providing local news and information for Columbia County in print and online. ColumbiaPaper.com. And Bassett Healthcare, providing information on partial knee replacement at educational seminars across central New York. Say no to kneepain.com for dates and locations.
Bob Berman, the astronomer, is here. It's 800-348-2551, and Bob's about to hit the bestseller list again. What's coming up?
Oh, the new book, Zapped, is coming out this week, this coming week. We've already got some great reviews, and I'm just told by the publisher more reviews coming out by the Wall Street Journal and the Monitor and Publishers Weekly. So,
what's it about?
Zapped. Well, the subtitle will tell it all. The subtitle is From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. So it's all about the discoveries. In some cases, it made the people famous and rich. Mm-hmm. In other cases, the discovery of some kinds of invisible light actually made the discoverer drop dead sooner. You know, I mean, there's a big disparity in what happened to the people. And all the discoveries were from 1800. That was the first one, William Herschel's discovery of infrared, to 1900 was the final one, which was gamma rays and what they do to us, what microwaves do to us. You know, we all know people who are very afraid of microwaves and everything you always wanted to know about the energies that are around us and with us and passing through our bodies all the time.
This kind of discovery, is it by accident? I mean, who decided if I aim this light or these rays at this person, I'll see his bones and get an X-ray? I mean, how did that just come about?
Yeah, that was accidental.
Yeah.
The very first one from William Herschel was totally accidental. No, I mean, the idea that there's light you can't see.
Right.
That would have been a hard sell to the great thinkers or the religious leaders or the ancient Greeks. No, nobody thought there was light you can't see. So that was strange. And he didn't need it because William Herschel had already been the only person to find a planet. He was the first and only person to discover a new planet when he discovered Uranus in 1781. So he was already widely celebrated around the world. He hardly needed anything to add to his resume. And yet here he goes in the year 1800, finding the first ever invisible light. And how did he do it? It was an accident. What happened is he was studying the sun through his telescopes, and he noticed that when he used filters to keep his eyes from getting fried, you know, very relevant to what we're talking about today with the total eclipse, that the different color glass filters would each block different amounts of light. But what was interesting to him, he felt heat coming through it. Heat was getting through these glass filters, different amounts of heat with different colors. And he seemed to notice that more heat came through the red filter than through the green or the blue filter. So what he did was he cast light, sunlight through on a prism, made a little rainbow on a table, and then he had three thermometers set up, two for controls just on the dark parts of the table, and then he took turns putting the third thermometer in different colors of sunlight. And he found that the thermometer did not increase very much at all in the blue or the green or the yellow, but in the red, it rose several degrees. Very interesting stuff. Hmm. And then he took a break, left the room. When he came back a while later, the sun had moved in the sky, so the colors cast by the prism had moved across the table. And now the thermometer that was just lying on the table happened to be sitting in a blank area that wasn't hit by the colored spectrum at all. It was happened to be sitting beyond the red end, and he looked at it, and the temperature was crazy high. The temperature had gone up the most when it was in the blank area beyond the red end of the spectrum. So he kept remeasuring with other thermometers, and then he realized there's a form of light, which is heat, that is invisible, that is just beyond the red part of the spectrum. He called it calorific rays, calorific, you know, calorie heat.
Right.
Calorific rays. And they called it that for a whole century before they started calling it infrared. So that's how he discovered that.
And who publishes Zapped?
Oh, Little Brown.
Little Brown?
Yep.
Out next week.
Out next week.
All right. Jonathan in Great Barrington, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Because some of the things that you're looking at in the celestial area are so far away, how, like, you know, hundreds or thousands of light years, how do you actually know that they're there at the time you're looking at them?
Well, we never know for sure. You're quite right that it takes light a certain amount of time to reach us, even at its super fast speed, 186,282.38 miles per second, really fast. But nonetheless, it takes a little time. I love the stat that a person that you see across the room from you, you're seeing them not as they are now, but the lights are reaching you as many billionths of a second ago, nanoseconds ago, as they are feet away from you. So if I'm sitting 20 feet from Brian, I'm not that quite that far from him, but if I'm 20 feet from him, I'm seeing him not as he is now, but as he was 20 nanoseconds, 20 billionths of a second in the past. So you're quite right. When we see the moon, its light is reaching us, having left a little over a second ago. The sun, as it was 8.5 minutes ago. Jupiter and Saturn, about an hour in the past. The nearest stars, about 4.5 years ago. And the nearest spiral galaxy, Andromeda, we're seeing it as it was 2.5 million years ago, which means that any Andromedans watching us through some kind of super telescope, if they have such a thing, are seeing our planet Earth at this moment as it was 2.5 million years ago. So they're not seeing not only not modern technology, but barely the human race at all. So we're always seeing the past. But, you know, rather than let that confuse us, we always define now as when light reaches us. Mm-hmm. For example, the supernova that was first seen just after the year 1000, in truth, it had taken almost 1,000. It had taken more than 1,000 years to reach us. But nobody later said, "Well, that supernova really went off more than 1,000 years before that." We just take the date when we saw it, which was July 4th in the year 1054, and we say that's when the supernova exploded, and we define the happening as when the light arrived, rather than go crazy and say, "Well, not really," because it took time for the light to reach us.
Okay. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling.
I don't think he was really happy with that answer.
Well, I don't know. I was. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. So if we look at a very distant star, one we can see without a telescope, one of those small, barely visible ones, that star may not still be there.
Yes, it might not. And I love it when people point that out, even though it's probably wrong, because it means they're grasping the enormity of space and the finite speed of light. But the greatest examples of that are probably the star Deneb in the Great Summer Triangle, because it's far away. Some say 1,500 light years, some say 2,200 light years. It's so far that we're not even sure of the distance, but it's at least 1,500 light years. So people say, well, in those 1,500 years, maybe the star exploded, maybe it's not there. But the truth is, stars last so long. They live typically for billions of years, and there are only 6,000 stars visible to the naked eye. So, and they're only, the nearest stars are a few light years away, the farthest are a few thousand. So if you do the math, what are the chances that even one star of the night sky is not there? And it blew up while its light was en route to us. Well, the light, it's so such a short time relative to the lifespan of stars that I once worked it out. The odds are about 200 to 1 that all the stars that we see are really still there anyway, even though it's possible they're not, but it's likely that they still are.
This is Vox Pop on WAMC. Let's talk to Betty in Albany. Betty, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I have a friend who has a condo on a barrier island 5 miles from Charleston, South Carolina. If the weather is good during the eclipse, what is the probability that fog will form to block it out.
Well, the good luck for Charleston as a site is that the eclipse there will be in the afternoon, will be mid-afternoon. So usually you get fog in the morning. You know, this is outside my field, of course. I'm not a meteorologist, but we all know that fog is, even in humid places like the Carolinas, fog is more commonly a morning thing. What I would worry about if I were trying to observe it from Charleston, where you're quite right, the eclipse will be total in Charleston, South Carolina. What I'd worry about is afternoon clouds building up, because with the humidity in the air that you typically get in the Carolinas in August, I'd be happier with a morning eclipse if it was late morning,
well,
9 or 10
I,
or 11.
I read an article online written by another astronomer who went to Africa or something to watch an eclipse, and he was by a lake, and he said that the temperature dropped so fast that dense fog formed, and he couldn't see the eclipse.
I see what you're saying. So that during the eclipse, the drop in the temperature, that has happened. For example, there was one in Siberia where a lake, I don't believe it was Lake Baikal, but it was one of the lakes where the world's astronomers were gathered on an island in the lake. And just exactly what you're saying occurred. The drop in temperature during the eclipse dropped the temperature below the dew point. And clouds formed. In that case, clouds formed and blocked the eclipse. So that could happen. But as I say, my greatest fear there would simply be the heat of the day causes buildups of cumulus clouds and thunderstorms to form. And when you're getting a mid-afternoon eclipse like you are in the Carolinas, I'd feel more comfortable if you were telling me that you were going to see it from, let's say, Carbondale, Illinois, where it's earlier in the afternoon, or Jackson Hole, actually the town is called Jackson, Wyoming, where it's going to be 10:30 in the morning, and then that would be maybe a little safer. But you know what? You have a friend there. I hope you're going. Are you going, or are you just concerned about your friend?
I'm still debating whether or not to go. I don't know.
Well, for
it's
me,
it's going to be awfully crowded. That's the only thing.
But you have a place to stay because you have a friend, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it were me, I'd go and just take my chances. Sure.
Thank you very much for calling 800-348-2551. Grace in Sheffield. Grace.
Hi. Probably better if I take it off speaker. Okay. When I got the welder plates for the number 14, and what I did was I took a piece of cardboard and your corrugated cardboard and cut out a piece of cardboard that was, you know, a couple inches bigger than the plate on all four sides, and then set the plate in the middle and traced it and then cut that out, and then you push the plate into that. And then put some tape on the four corners on each side. And then that gives you more protection so you don't accidentally look at the sun. And
well, you can do that. You're talking about creating a kind of hood or helmet with the filter, the welding filter right in the middle of it in the opening. And so you can sort of wear it, and then the rest of the cardboard will block the rest of the light. You could do that, but I will tell you this.
I don't wear it. I just keep in the file. You know, so it's flat. But it does protect your eyes more, gives you more protection around that plate.
Yeah, you could do that. But truth to tell, being a veteran of many eclipses, it's true that the welding goggle filters are only about 2 inches by 4 or 5 inches in size, and you have to hold them in front of you blocking the sun. However, in my experience, that works just fine. And also, if you should get a fraction of a second hit of sun because you moved your hand a little bit and jiggled it so that the real sunlight hits your eyes, that's not going to hurt you. And the proof of it is we've all, in our youth, in your case it sounds like you still have youth, have glanced at the sun, haven't we, throughout our lives without harm. And the reason why we didn't get harmed, I'll tell you why, because although blue and green light is generally the most harmful to the eyes, that's what causes cataracts, for example, over a lifetime of exposure. For an eclipse, the main thing is thermal damage from the near infrared. So you're talking about the red and the near infrared cooking, especially there's a dark layer of pigment right under the retina, and that heats up so much it can actually destroy retinal cells. But it takes a few seconds for this heat to build up. So a fraction of a second of sun hitting your eye doesn't do it. You've got to stare at the sun, which unfortunately is what we do during eclipses. A lot of us are stupid enough, myself included in the past, to stare at the sun. And that's what you don't want to do, because then the heat builds up on the retina, can even produce blindness. But if you're holding up a filter with your hand and you jiggle your hand a little bit and a moment of sunlight goes into your eye, don't worry about it. I promise you that won't hurt you.
Thank you for calling. It's 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman is here. We'll be back in a moment.
Support comes from the Poughkeepsie Public Library District, offering resources for gardeners, builders, researchers, artists, and lovers of literature. POKLIB.org. Vintage 20 Wine and Spirits, Duanesburg, New York, providing an array of libations, wine, and spirits. Tastings Thursday and Friday, open 7 days per week. Your route to savings, 518-895-1098. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. And Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York. Specializing in distinctive eyewear, including Zenka from Paris and Coco Song from Italy. Eye exams by appointment. EYEDENTITY eyewearalbany.com.
It's 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Richard in Queensbury.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it would be nice if somebody would make an IMAX digital film of the eclipse and the surrounding events, something you could watch in the theater.
That's a great idea. But I will say, now being a veteran of a bunch of them, that it's so powerful, it's so beautiful and powerful that the film and photographs and still photographs really don't capture it either visually or certainly vibe-wise. I hate to say vibe. It sounds like I'm from near Woodstock, which I am. Mm-hmm. But the feeling, the power that comes from this event is something that's beyond the visual. But when it comes to the visual, listen to this. When you take a picture or a cinematographer takes a movie of it, the eclipse sun has this bright inner corona, which includes these flames, these prominences, and then has this delicate, wonderful outer, much dimmer corona with these delicate lines of the sun's magnetic field. Well, they require very different exposures, because if you take the correct exposure to get the outer corona, you're going to overexpose and burn out the inner corona so that it just looks like a white blob. You know what I'm saying? But the eye, for some reason, is able to see this great gradation of brightness. So when you're actually there seeing it, you see something that the photographs do not capture. So I know it sounds snobby to say, yeah, it would be great in an IMAX movie to see the total eclipse. And you'll get something from that. But, gee, go to one in person and you'll come back to me, contact me, and you're going to say, you're right. That's just something. It's sort of like, you know, like people take pictures of births sometimes. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever been to a birth, there's something like really magical in the air. You can almost feel angels' wings flapping or something, whereas in real life it's sort of a kind of a bloody mess. It's just that I don't know if it's an attractive experience at all. There's some things you got to be there, is what I'm saying.
No, I'm thinking of going, so.
Oh, I hope you do.
Well, thank you very much for calling. It's 800-348-2551. Jim is in Adams. Jim.
Yeah, hi. Two quick questions about the eclipse. First, I just want to confirm it is safe to look at the total, the 2 minutes of total, without protection.
Yes, not only is it safe, but you can even use binoculars. You can even enhance the light. And we do. The people in our group, including myself, we usually spend about half the time looking at it directly, no filters, and about half the time using equipment like a telescope or binoculars. And it's perfectly safe. It's very gentle light during totality.
Okay. Now, I'm headed down to southwest North Carolina for this. And my plan was to get up in the morning, check the weather, and make a decision. So my question is, and it may sound a little strange, but in the grand scheme of things, this eclipse is moving fast, and there's no way to catch up to it, right? In other words, you got to pick a spot and stay there and hope for the best, because it's moving too fast. You can't, it's not like you can drive ahead of it and catch it down the road, so to speak.
Unless you opted for the big engine on the car that could make you go 2,000 miles an hour.
Oh, I thought it was 500 miles an hour, but I guess 2,000 is.
It's more like 1,700, actually. It's a little under 2,000, but yeah, it's too fast. Now, you got to choose your spot, and you're doing it wisely. You're going to check the forecast, and then you'll decide whether you're going to go west to Tennessee or south to South Carolina, right?
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, that's smart.
Okay, great. Right. Thanks.
Thank you very much for calling. Larry in Boston Spa. Larry?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Two quick questions. Number one, I live in Boston Spa, let's say the Albany area. What's the closest way to see as much of the eclipse as you can to this area without having to travel far? Because I can't do that.
Well, as we were saying before, a partial eclipse is a partial eclipse. I know it sounds snobby, but I've got to say it. A partial eclipse is a miss. You've missed the event. You've not seen totality, because all the cool stuff that makes people act up and animals act up happens at totality. So if you're not going to go to where it's total, and from here, the closest places would be either almost due west or slightly southwest, Carbondale, Illinois, south to the Carolinas. If you're not going to get into the path of totality, then honestly, it really doesn't matter whether you see a 79% obscuration or an 81 or an 83. You'll never see the difference in that. And we get those kind every few years, and it's kind of mildly interesting. The same way watching beavers build a dam is interesting, but it's not going to make you weep. It's not going to change your life. And make sure you have eye protection. Actually, you need eye protection even for totality, because before it's total and after, there's a partial eclipse that you want to see. So the filter for eye protection is necessary no matter what.
Now, you have that filter. Can you just hold it up and look through the filter, or do you have to make a device?
No, just hold it up. Just hold it up.
Okay. I appreciate that. And there's no charities that help people out, you know, like if they...
That's plenty. I love that. Charities to send you to the total eclipse. Let's start a charity, and we'll start with me sending me to... Actually, the years, because I've been, you know, running. I'm paid to go to them. I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm covered. Now, let's start a charity for everybody else to get to total eclipses. Yeah.
How much does that welder's glass cost?
$2.
That's
a good
investment.
Yeah.
800-34...
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. 800-348-2551. Mark is in Albany, and Mark, like you, Bob, has seen a total eclipse. Mark, you want to tell us about it? Mark?
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Yes. I'm at my doctor's appointment in Albany right now, so I'm going to step outside. I was in the Navy. Station in Little Creek, Virginia, in 1970, I believe it was.
Yeah. Yep. March 7th, 1970.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And it was very, very interesting. It's one of the person was saying how it got cold and the fog came off the lake. We went to Sandbridge, which is on the North Carolina line, and watched it on the beach. And it was phenomenal. It was, it came from, of course, east to west. And it was like everything was, you know how you hold a light up to a fan and it makes the light vibrate?
Yeah.
Now that's exactly what it did coming across the ocean.
Right. So that has that inspired you to see this one, or are you going to skip it?
There's no way I can make it to South Carolina. I'd love to go to South Carolina, but I can't do it.
Okay. Well, yeah, next one, remember, 2024.
The birds.
Yeah, we'll have one in 2024, so...
Well, yeah, it got cold up down there and chilly, and when it turned dark, all the birds stopped chirping, and then after a little while, everything came back to normal, but it was just phenomenal. I just wanted to pass that on.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Mark. 800-348-2551. Rick is in Hyde Park. Rick?
Hi, Bob and Ray.
Hi.
We're going to Kentucky to see the eclipse, and
the place where we're going is a golf course, and they say they're about 7 miles from the center line. Are we going to be close enough, or should we get closer?
No, 7 miles is fine. The path at that place will be about 70 miles wide, and as long as you're in the central 20 or 25 miles or so, you'll see the full length of the eclipse. As you start getting to the edges, you lose time, is what you do. But where you're going to be just a few miles from the center line, you're fine.
Terrific. Okay. Thank you.
Good luck to you with the weather.
Thank you very much for calling. David is in Chatham. David.
Hi. I may be misinformed, but my understanding is that stellar distances and luminosities are determined by reference to something called the standard candle. And since we can't, as far as I know, measure distances directly, how do we construct that? Is that a theoretical construct, or is that a real object? And if we're off on our base assumptions, does that mean all our assumptions about distances and luminosities are also incorrect?
Yes, they would be incorrect if you start the ladder. The bottom steps of the ladder are wrong. So what's used is, you're absolutely right, there are stars such as Vega, magnitude zero, that do not flicker. Many stars are variable, but Vega is not. So that served as a reference, as the standard candle for a long time. And once you know how bright a particular star is and got its distance pegged, in Vega's case, it's 25 light years, and we measure that directly with parallax. So we have star distances pinned down to a fraction of one light year if they're a relatively nearby star. And then we recognize that there's families of stars, that a certain spectral type, spectral lines, show that this star gives off a certain amount of light. So it serves like, we know it's a 60-watt light bulb, a 75-watt light bulb. We know how bright it is in absolute terms. And then when we see another star and measure its distance and see its brightness, it all fits in. So that system lets us take bigger and bigger steps and determine the distances and the brightnesses of really everything in the universe.
And that works for any type of star, not just the main sequence star?
Yeah, you're even using the right term, main sequence stars. It's true that strange stars that are underluminous or overluminous can initially throw you off. For example, you get a star that's a certain spectral type, let's say M, like let's say Betelgeuse. Now, most stars of spectral class M are little dwarf stars and they're very dim. But now you've got this huge star that's much brighter than it should be, and it doesn't make sense. And then you realize, I see why it's so bright, because there's so many square feet of star surface, because it's unusually huge. So it has a bigger radiating area, so it's giving off more light, even though every square foot of that star is still pretty dim. In the case of Betelgeuse, the red stars are pretty dim per square foot, but there's so many square feet that makes it a brighter star. So yes, what you're saying is quite right.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling, 800-348-2551. And let's see, Wanda. No, I'm talking to, John. John in Williamstown, go ahead.
Hello, Bob. I've been a subscriber to Astronomy Magazine since the mid-70s and then have thoroughly enjoyed your column that's appeared, I guess, the last couple decade or so.
Yeah, thank you.
Great stuff. The question I have is non-eclipse, although I'm lucky enough to have a sister living in Nashville, so my wife and I are going to go down there and
check out
my first, and I've been waiting for this for decades.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad. Good luck.
But my question is simply this, and at the risk of sounding a little bit like an astronomy nerd, it's something that's kind of puzzled me. As I understand it, an object that has mass, accelerate that object to the speed of light would require converting all the mass in the universe into energy. It's
quite right, yes.
Okay, so a photon, two questions then. A photon has mass. How can it be traveling the speed of light? And what is the perspective of, what is the perspective from a photon's view of time if it's traveling the speed of light?
Yes. Great questions, and deep questions too. A photon has no rest mass. It only has equivalent mass. What I mean by that is that to compare apples with apples, since the faster an object moves, the more mass it has, the more energy it has, and mass and energy have an equivalency. So anything that's moving automatically has more mass in it. So to make sense of all this, we pretend that nothing is moving relative to anything else, and we say, so what is its rest mass? So we could say, what's the rest mass of a uranium nucleus? What's the rest mass of a hydrogen nucleus? And photons have no rest mass because they can't be stopped. A photon, its nature is to move. You simply can't stop it. So it has zero rest mass, and that's its, that's the escape clause that lets it go at the speed of light, even though it weighs nothing.
Now, all right, I'll deal with that later. Okay.
Now, as to what it would experience, you're quite right that as you go faster, strange things happen with distance and with time. With time, you would feel, as you went faster and faster, your time would slow down from everyone else's perspective, but not yours. So if you're destined to have to live for 85 years, let's say, in this life, you'd continue to feel your life passing normally, and you'd still live for 85 years, and there'd be nothing that would change about that. But anyone else observing you through a super telescope would see your time slowing down. At the same time, you see distances getting weird. Like in front of you, as you're heading at almost the speed of light, I'll use real numbers, at 99.999999999, 7 nines after the decimal point, you'd have a time day dilation factor of 22,361, meaning that for every light year of distance that you see in front of you, the rest of the world insists that there's really 22,000 light years in front of you. So let's say you're heading toward the center of the galaxy, which is about 25,000 light years away. Everyone back on Earth watching you at almost the speed of light says, well, this guy, even though he's traveling almost the speed of light, is going to have to travel for 25,000 years before he reaches the center of the galaxy. But that's not what you experience. You actually get there in 1 year, because to you the distance to the center of the galaxy is only one light year, not 22,000 light years anymore. So distance has changed, time has changed from everyone's perspective, and because all these things are weird from different perspectives, that's what Einstein's relativity was about. That's what the word relative means. He was saying, hey, it's all relative.
Right.
One person sees a distance being this, but time being that, and the other person says, no, time is this and distance is that. And his formulae, his equations, showed us how they convert from one to the other, and everything made sense. To a photon, they see no distance at all between themselves and anything else. So in other words, if you were a photon of light or could travel at the speed of light, you'd be everywhere in the universe at once.
Okay. I was wondering then if a photon traveling from essentially one edge of the observable universe to the other, to us it would take, you know, 25 billion, you know, years. For it, it's instantaneous.
Correct.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. Great. All right.
Thank you very much for calling, Bob. Just a few minutes left. What are you going to learn? What do astronomers learn from this eclipse? I mean, the science of it. What research do we get out of it? What conclusions do we get out of an eclipse that maybe we didn't know about the sun and the moon and the stars before?
Well, the big question for a long time was making sense of that corona. Since you see the corona during an eclipse and no other time, why is it so hot? The corona is 4 million degrees, and yet the gaseous surface of the sun, the photosphere, is only 10,500 degrees. Why should it get so much hotter as you go farther from the sun? Actually, when you first go away from the sun, it's kind of cool. It's cool enough to have water vapor. But then as you go farther and farther, the sun's atmosphere is this crazy temperature, enough to break atoms into little bits, and that's why you even see a corona, because it's plasma, meaning broken bits of atoms. So you want to learn, why is that happening? And in the most recent years, we've been actually discovering why. It has to do with the magnetic field lines disconnecting, snapping open, reconnecting. It's all magnetically driven.
So are you saying that corona gets hotter?
Yes.
At that moment?
Yes, yeah. Well, no, not at that moment. The corona is hot, and we're trying to, because we can study it then, and at no other time except with the coronagraph, We're trying to figure out what's going on and why. However, for the likes of me looking at the eclipse, I'm not learning anything. What I'm doing is just letting in this incredible beauty. It's like witnessing the creation of the universe, or the birth of the Grand Canyon, or something along the lines of something you've never seen before and will never see again. It's so gorgeous. It's beyond words. So
Bob Berman is our guest. The new book is Zapped. It comes out next week. Bob, have a good time.
Thank you, Brian.
Wear your goggles. We are out of time. I want to thank everyone who called in and apologize to those we left on the line. Thanks to astronomer Bob Berman for stopping by. Support for WAMC comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company. Coffee roasted for friends, Matigue and McClellan, buyers of gold, diamonds, and jewelry since 1895, gemologists and appraisers, evaluating and buying in Great Barrington and New York. Appointments suggested, mc2jewels.com. The Alt, an alternative weekly providing the capital area with in-depth coverage of news, arts, culture, and community. Provoke, inform, inspire, thealt.com. Basin Harbor, Lake Champlain, Vermont. Lakefront accommodations for vacations, weddings, and conferences, featuring a championship golf course. And a new boat club, 40 slips for overnight stays, basinharbor.com for details. Calls answered today by Deb Malik, producer Jim Lavoulis. I'm Brian Shields. Tomorrow is Food Friday.